Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
In a sudden flash, it all comes clear. It's a eureka moment, an epiphany. Hi, I'm Marcus Smith, host of the Constant Wonder podcast. The world offers marvel, meaning, and mystery around every single corner. In nature, art, science, culture, history, we talk everything from bees and beetles to obelisks and asteroids. Experience the thrill of transformative encounter. We'll bring more wonder to your day.
Listen to Constant Wonder wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome to another episode of History Hack. We've got one of my favourite archaeologists on today. Alex, tell us who we got.
Oh, we've got Richard Osgood, who is also an author. He's archaeological advisor to the government, and he's also, I think, currently archaeologist of the year. Does this mean you get to open dig sites by cutting ribbons wearing a bathing suit?
You know, you've just put everybody off the whole programme, haven't you, with that image? That's horrific. That is absolutely, that's like worse than Borat. Sadly, that's run out, but no, I didn't have to have any of those duties, fortunately for the world, I think, probably.
What did it mean? Did you get a trophy?
Yeah, I did. I got a really lovely flint trophy. It was a good day out. It was a really nice day out with Current Archaeology, who were fantastic. So that was a good fun evening with a couple of my friends. And it's given a lot of mileage to the military guys I work with to take the mickey out of me. So that's also good.
Can I just add, I'm one of those people that voted for you.
You're a star. You and my mother. That's really good. I'm sure Alex is only having me on today given her football allegiance because of my surname. I'm pretty sure.
Pretty much.
Yeah, I thought so.
Just against my better judgment, entered myself in a ballot to be one of about five people allowed to go to the Leeds game.
Oh, really? Leeds against Chelsea? Leeds against Chelsea was altogether different, wasn't it?
Yeah, we love watching that on YouTube because there's no football. It's just basically a riot.
Yeah, Leeds against Chelsea.
But we're not here to talk about mud today, because that was horrific, wasn't it, that cup final replay. We're going to talk about different mud. We're going to do World War One archaeology with you today, aren't we?
Yeah, that sounds good.
So tell us a bit about the action at Bullecourt and why there was stuff there for you to find. When and why did it happen?
Well, Bullecourt's a really interesting action, actually. It's probably one of the ones that lots of people, unless they're into the First World War, have never heard about. It's part of the Battle of Arras, which takes place in the snow in April 1917. And this is after the Germans had withdrawn after the Somme campaign to a line called the Hindenburg Line, which enables them to defend a smaller area with the numbers of troops that they've got. And the offensive that took place from an Allied perspective is the British, Australians, Canadians and others were basically assaulting this line in support of the French Nivelle offensive further south. So By 1917, the time of the battle, the British are actually in charge of Arras. They're running the city itself. If you get the chance to go to Arras, it's one of the most gorgeous places in France, I think, a really, really beautiful city. You can get below the city into the caves that were used by the Allied forces, and you see the carvings left by New Zealanders and others are carved into these old chalk quarries. It's a really moving place to go to. And Bullecourt is almost an afterthought. This is where the 4th Australian Division was situated, and they fight with some of the more British divisions, like the West Ridings. And they fight in with the tanks to attack this Hindenburg position. They're under the command of General Gough at this point, and it doesn't go well. The tanks are taken out. We'll talk about the tanks a bit later on. The tanks don't succeed in their objectives. The Australians suffer more captured soldiers from this one battle than any other battle in the entire war, and it's left quite a mark. So Bullecourt was not, the first battle of Bullecourt in April, wasn't a huge success. That is a curiosity. It starts off with great success, with lots of movement, lots of progression, up to the best days of the Battle of the Somme. They succeed in pushing the Germans quite a bit further backwards. They do succeed in a certain amount of surprise. And so the early days are looking very, very promising for this Allied breakthrough. It peters out, and the counterattacks eventually mean that the casualties suffered by both sides are pretty high, they're equal. But the longed hope for breakthrough, final breakthrough, doesn't actually emerge. So it's probably a stalemate in many ways, but with that, lots of lives lost on both sides. And no one's really heard of it, have they? Unless you've really studied the First World War. People seem to think of the Somme or Passchendaele, that sort of thing. But Arras is not really one that they thought of. And if you don't think of Arras, you certainly don't think of Bullecourt down to the south.
Absolutely. You've mentioned that tanks were involved. Yeah. How good were they at Bullecourt? How effective were they? Were they an integral part of the fighting?
They were certainly an integral part of the planning for the first battle of Bullecourt. Tanks, I'm sure you know, come in 1916, towards the end of the Battle of the Somme. They emerge in September in a place called Fleur-Courtelette, and that's when they're first used in anger. And they are, I think they're a great tribute to the Allies in being imaginative and trying to work out how on earth to break this stalemate, to break through these static defences, and all these incredible inventions that happened in the First World War. The tanks are probably up there. You look at the design today of tanks, not hugely dissimilar. Two tracks that you can operate individually, big bit of armour with guns. It's fundamentally the same design. So these wonder weapons emerge in September, and then they are used at Bullecourt, where the plan is to have 11 of these tanks to break the German barbed wire, to soften up the German defences. And after that's happened, then the Australian infantry, the 4th Australian Division, will capture the positions and the Allies will have great success. That's the hoped for outcome. Now, the tanks used, first, the Mark 1 tanks used in September of 1916, they have these two big steering wheels on the back. And fundamentally, by April 17, they've not changed massively. They're not incredibly well armoured. They are armoured, but they're not incredibly strong. If you hit with artillery, the tank is almost certainly knocked out. And you've got to think that their maximum speed on a nice flat tarmac surface is 4 miles an hour. So really, they are just colossal targets. You've got a petrol engine inside, spitting fumes and heating it up inside with a crew of 8 cramped into this particular contraption. So although they are a phenomenal idea, they're still in the teething phases. So although integral to the battle, they're not a wild success.
They don't sound like very good fun, do they?
No, I think it would have been very, very brave individuals to go into these things, especially when you've seen them not working particularly well. The tanks at Bullecourt, 11 of them, are used. They're going to the start line. They arrive late. In fact, the battle is delayed. A delay. It starts on the 11th of April in the morning in the snow. So you've got these very obvious targets up against the snow. And of the 103 tank men involved in the Battle of Bullecourt, the first battle, 52 are killed. So you've got a death rate of over half of one particular unit. And that just shows you just how tough a job that was. Setting aside all the breakdowns of the vehicles anyway, these were dangerous things to be anywhere near.
So I have to ask you then, what happens to the tanks? Because they just tend to ditch, don't they, or get blown out and they don't go anywhere.
It must have been horrific watching this as the infantry, because this is your main support. You're not using your artillery because that's going to destroy the battlefield. There's a bit of artillery, but nothing like the bombardment we come to associate with the
first. 32 tons?
These are 28 tons, the Mark
28 II. Tons just sitting on the battlefield then.
Absolutely. So these 28 ton behemoths, they make their move. They are gradually destroyed. Some do break through some of the initial German positions, but they're so unreliable, they tend to break down. And once they're isolated, because they're not going in with the infantry support, it's a tactic they learn later, then they're easily destroyed. And these things then sit there. If they break down, you're trapped in it as a crew. You are just a big target and you attract artillery, so you've got to try and get out somehow. Once they're destroyed, you've just got this lump of armour on the battlefield. And you can see from some of the maps that are left behind by later units that use the battlefield, these are Allied maps, you get little sketches that say knocked out tank now used as a German observation position or a German machine gun position. So they are, because they're slightly forward of German lines, the Germans are able to reutilise them and give themselves bits of cover. So the British will then hit them with artillery and things like that. So these 11 tanks go into action. Actually, 9 are taken out on the battlefield. So 9 of these tanks are destroyed in the early hours of April 1917 on the 11th and just fly out on the battlefield.
this is key, isn't it? Because the Germans have missed the boat completely with tanks. And this is the first time that, so if we're not going to drag them away, by God, they are, aren't they? And they're going to pull them apart and see how they work.
Yeah, you're quite right, Alex. This is the opportunity the Germans have wanted. It's a colossal shock for them when they first see armoured vehicles, as it would be. It's a just total change in battlefield tactics. And so they've been desperate to be able to evaluate them properly. And this is that rare opportunity, because these things are lying on the battlefield. And the German photographs at the time, you've got the air photographs after the battle where they're able to work out the routes taken by the tanks, because the tanks have left marks in the mud, so they're able to trace those. They're getting all the intelligence reports back. But now they've got the physical remains of these tanks. And they're not only a thing of curiosity for the high command, the average German soldier is fascinated by them. You know, if you want to go onto German eBay and put in a search for a First World War tank, you will find postcards of these things all over. They're quite often marked up as being from the famous tank battle of 20th of November, Cambrai, but they're usually not. They're usually bullet corps. This is the first time the Germans have got them, and everyone's getting photographs taken with the English tanks, these huge new designs, new vehicles. And the Germans are able to then take them away, or even in the field, evaluate their tactics and ammunition against them. It's a real breakthrough in some ways for the German high command, but in others it leads to a bit of a false sense of security, because I said these are Mark II tanks. Traditionally they've been associated as being training tanks, not fully armoured. So when November comes, the British have got a totally different vehicle, the Mark IV, which is more armoured, it's more powerful, and the German tactics that they've evaluated largely from the actions at Bulacor are not anywhere near as effective, and it's a great shock to them.
So what brought you to Bulacor? Because clearly it was not Dickie's exceptional excavation skills, was it?
Well, do you know what? I hope you're going to play this to him. And he'll email and probably your address. So I'd be very careful what you put out. The reason actually was because I was actually with Dickie at a place called the Peace Village in Messines, another very famous 1917 battlefield. And we were doing some field work at Ypres, actually. A commercial development was going on, and we were looking for the remains left behind in a British cemetery called New Irish Palm. And whilst we were there, we met up with a fabulous guy called Dave Mutter, who's ex-British infantry and now works as professional bomb disposal over in Belgium and France. So you can imagine he's pretty busy, given the amount of ordnance you find out there. And he's had a lifelong interest in Bulacor and has been very keen to put together a fieldwork package. And collectively, we decided that the thing that we associated with the battle as novices in that particular campaign, as opposed to Dave, was tanks. And that it piqued my interest to see, they're so photographed, they're so well known, these individual tanks, but was there any chance of anything being left in the ground? Or had it all been retrieved after the battle by the Germans, or indeed after the war by the British and the Chinese Labour Corps to recover the scrap value? And if you go to Bulacor today, museum, which is lovely, a little museum in the village itself, has got lots and lots of bits of tank that's been retrieved over the years by the farmers as part of their recycling and just general interest. So was there anything left in the ground that we could look at archaeologically, and could we get anything additional to our history of Bulacor and the positions of the tanks from that particular fieldwork? The one thing I thought it would give us potentially is where the tanks finally ended, because there are lots of little tiny sketch maps, but they're the size of a postage stamp. Mm-hmm. Be able to get a bit more specific detail on where the final points these tanks reached through archaeology, I thought would be a valuable thing, if nothing else.
Absolutely. You chose a particular tank to go after, didn't you, in the end?
We did. We thought the overall plan is still to look for the locations of all the nine tanks that were destroyed, so we mm-hmm. can get a fix on where they got to. And the first two we chose were tank 797, which was destroyed right next to the battalion headquarters of the 48th Australian Battalion of the 4th Australian Division by the railway embankment from which the attack launched. And the other one was 796, commanded by a Scotsman called Second Lieutenant Skinner. And this is the tank that makes it closest to the centre of the village of Bulacor. We thought that would be a good one to go to, not least because its potential location was in a pasture field, which meant that we didn't have to disrupt any cropping, and it meant it was more suitable for our geophysical surveys and things like that. So 797 and 796 were the two we chose. Both were what we call mail tanks. So these are the ones with the big naval six-pounder guns sticking out from them. It's a very obvious schoolboy reference, really, long sticky-out thing from the side of it.
What are the names? People are going to know what the tank names were.
But you know what? These ones aren't actually named.
These really are.
Yeah, in the bullet call, the tanks aren't actually given names. These are a D something or other. I can't remember.
Oh, sad times.
I know. Maybe we should give them a name. I don't know.
Yeah. No. Well, they have to begin with D, don't they?
Yeah, Dickie. Yeah,
be Dickie.
I think Dickie deserves. Look, I may joke around about Dickie. We do that, but he is an exceptional archaeologist, and I do.
Dickie
think
and
should...
Dumbo. There we go.
Right, you got.
I like elephants, one. So.
So there you go. So tank 796 RB is not got a particularly auspicious name, but we look for 797. The interesting thing is we only got two very small permissions from the French authorities because it was new to them doing First World Archaeology in this particular village. So we were sort of a strange entity to them. So they gave us two permissions of 5 meters by 5 meters in a very big battlefield. So we had to do some very careful looking at air photographs and geophysics and field walking, all the traditional archaeological techniques, so we could put our trench in the right place. Now, tank 797, our 5 meter by 5 meter hole, found pretty much nothing. It was a big artillery crater, which did have some metallic elements in it, things like screw pickets, but no traces of the tank at all, which was a bit of a disappointment. You've got a full field team out there just looking for the tank. So that left us with our one real opportunity, which was Skinner's tank 796. And luckily enough, we did come up trumps there.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I mean, you've told us how you found it. Can you give us a little bit more detail on that?
Yeah. So the first thing we did with this is you go through the battlefield and we call field walk. It is as simple as walking up and down the field, noting where there's concentrations of material, looking for the metallic elements and trying to see if there are any bits of tank and plotting where those are and working out how much blast would have affected that or the power moving it around. We didn't actually find any bits of tank in the field walking, but there was lots of First World War material. For 796, the main way of locating it was through the air photographs, which are phenomenal. There's some wonderful German photographs that you can still see online of this tank in amongst this moonscape of the shattered village of Bullecourt. And then you can sort of triangulate that, and then you use the maps written by the Germans and the Australian infantry as to roughly where it was, and then go through the author's works, people like Paul Kendall, who've written some great books on Bullecourt. Just trying to see roughly where it would be. Charles Bean's map in the Australian archives too. So we had a rough idea, and then from that point in, we did some geophysical survey, testing the magnetic components in the soil, just to see where we could trace the trenches. And through all these different bits, you're whittling it down. It's like a big Venn diagram. And we took a punt, especially to the diary said the tank 796 broke down right on the edge of this huge crater, which is why it was therefore rendered it absolutely infunctional. So we thought, let's put our 5 meter by 5 meter on top of the edge of that crater, roughly where the photograph said it would be, roughly where the geophysics said it would be. So it was a bit of a punt, but it did come off because we did find quite a bit of the tank.
Oh, so tell us what you found and how it was uncovered then.
Well, we've been two seasons on site now. The first season, if you've ever seen an archaeological site, or any of your listeners have, the curiosity and the thing that always happens is you find the best bits usually on the last day, and usually it's right on the edge of the trench, so you have to extend it a wee bit to get it out. But on the first year, we found bits of the link that drives the tank. It's like a big bicycle chain that the engine turns the tracks around, so we found bits of that link. We also found bits of the ammunition, we think 6-pound shell found by fired by these particular vehicles. But the real excitement for us was finding quite a big length, about 2 meters of the track itself, and it had these things called grousers, or some people call them spuds, which are extensions from the track to give it extra grip. So massive piece of link of First World War tank track in the position where we thought 796 was, and there aren't that many tanks that had used that area, so pretty much it has to have come from 796. So we were right on the money. That was really exciting. And the second year, we found quite a bit more. So much so we put about one ton of the 28 tons of this tank. So there's still a bit to find. More of the shells, some of the percussion cap protectors from the ammunition, bits of the gun as well, which said the letters EWC, which is all that's left of a little plaque that would have said Newcastle. which is where the gun was made by Armstrong.
Ah.
Oil taps, bits, quite a bit of the engine, lots of the gear cogs, the engineer's hammer. And we found one fired 6-pounder shell case, which was stamped April 17. And that was really good because that illustrated the logistical genius by this point, I think, of the Allied armies in being able to fabricate a shell, fill it with explosives, get it to the shipping ports, get it over to the Western Front, get the fuse in, put it into the vehicles, drive it up to the battlefield and fired all within a few days. It really is a phenomenal effort. Just the sheer organizational skills by this point of the Allied armies is phenomenal.
That's so mad.
Really exciting.
Can I ask you what colour it was? Because there's all kinds of different sort of dazzle schemes in that. There's not a unit. Was there a uniform colour for tanks? There wasn't, was there?
That's a really good question too. I mean, I think everyone's got their own opinions what it might be. And lots of people will have been to the Tank Museum in Bovington or seen other tanks elsewhere. And they're painted all manner of colours, really, aren't they? Sort of a khaki or a dusty brown or a green or whatever. There's all sorts of different colours that are given to it. But you've got to remember all the tanks that are in the museums have been repainted so many times that some of the original paint is really not there. Well, we did find some of the original paint on this track, and there was the red primer, which I guess is ubiquitous on most military vehicles, as an undercoat. And on top of that, and I'm not saying the whole tank was painted this colour, certainly some of it was. It was a dark green colour. And if you look at the Pantone, and we have done that, it's more or less an approximation of a British racing green. And when you think this tank would have done 4 miles an hour, as I said, flat out. British racing green. The reason I think it's that colour, Alex, is probably because this tank was made by Foster's of Lincoln. And
okay.
Foster's made called the traction engines for agricultural purposes before the war. And their engineering skills are then reutilised into making tanks. And I think loads of these traction engines at this time are painted that green colour. And I think they've probably just done a generic, let's paint the tank that colour in the first place. The army may well have painted it a different colour later on or put camouflage colours, sort of dazzle ship style onto it. That's quite possible. But certainly part of the tank, at least, was painted a racing green in its first iteration.
Oh, I like that.
Many of the guys on our veterans working with us who are making models, and lots of them do, to have a good start to know what colour to paint their little airfix kit.
Do we know what happened to the crews?
Yeah, they all survived. I mentioned of the sheer casualty rates within this particular unit fighting. Well, Skinner, the tank breaks down on the edge of the crater, as I've mentioned, and he's therefore in a large target and decides the best thing to do is no point staying there fighting because the Germans have moved up these 77mm artillery pieces and they're firing point blank at the tank and it's flying off. So he decides the sensible option is to try and retreat to Allied lines. So he gets the guys to recover as much material from inside the tank as they can, including some of the machine guns, and they retreat back to Allied lines. The entire crew survives this particular battle, and as a result, Skinner's awarded the Military Cross. We don't know, sadly, the names of any of those members of the crew. We just know that they all survived. The only guy we do know, typically, is the officer in command, which is Second Lieutenant Skinner, and he survives the entire war. So unlike much of the tank tank story, this was a much more positive one for this crew at Bullecourt.
Can you talk to us as well, just on the historical front, about this idea that the Australians were so pissed by this experience at Bullecourt that they refused to go into action with tanks again? That doesn't sound right.
Yeah, this is one of the great stories about Bullecourt, because the 4th Australian Division, in many ways, it's a who's who of some of the real celebrities of the Australian Army. You have Albert Jacka, who is known as Mad Jacka by many people. He's got a Victoria Cross already. He's also got a Military Cross and Bar. And if you speak to some authorities about Jacka, they said he probably should have had 3 VCs, but it wasn't awarded because he was a bit of a larrikin in some ways and didn't play by the rules. He's an incredibly brave character. He wins his second MC at Bullecourt for laying out the mine tape on which the tanks are meant to follow, and he sees a German officer's located this. It's a bit like that scene in the Bridge on the River Kwai film where the guy sees the telecommunication wire and then tries to pull it in. Well, he sees a German officer who's found this, so he goes over, knocks out the German, and brings him back to Allied lines for questioning, which is just phenomenal. Wins an MC for it. So he's there. You've got Harry Murray, who is another VC winner. And you've also got Percy Black, and Percy Black was described by Murray as being the bravest man in the Australian army. So you've got these three incredible characters. Now, they report very, very badly. Well, Black's killed, but Jacker and Murray report very unfavourably about the actions of the tanks, as do some of the men of the 48th Battalion, who are based in the railway embankment. And the story goes round, and it's in some of the apocryphal histories of the Great War, that the Australians, as a result, because they've suffered so many casualties in this battle, and it's a perceived colossal failure, that they refused to have anything to do with the tanks later on for quite a long time in the war. And it's just not true, because later on that particular year, they're still fighting alongside tanks. And in fact, in June 1917, when the Battle of Messines takes place, it's almost an all-arms campaign with aircraft, and tanks are used there as well. And they're used again in Passchendaele later on in the Third Battle of Ypres. So much so that by 1918, the Australian General Monash, 3rd Division, he uses them as an integral part of his work that fights around Amiens in the all-arms campaign. So certainly they can see the problems with tanks, but it's not something that they desperately think that they will never work with them again. There are criticisms of the British tank crew, saying, by some of them as well, saying they were particularly timid. But I think just from those casualty rates, you can see why you wouldn't necessarily stay in a tank if it's destroyed, damaged, just taking incoming fire. That would be so utterly foolhardy. I think the tank crews were criticised pretty harshly.
Did you find any bodies at Bullecourt?
Yeah, the Bullecourt work's been interesting because, as you'd imagine, the amount of people killed in the first war, and those, you know, go to the Menin Gate or some of the other memorials, you know how many missing people there are out on the battlefields, and Bullecourt's no exception. We found the remains of, let me see, 1, 2, 3 German soldiers, and then partial remains. And the partial remains are, we presume, Allied, in that they're in either Allied trenches or they've got Allied kit on them, but you'll never be able to prove it. So the main Allied remains we found was in the second year of the program, and we found a boot. So it was an Allied boot, and the foot was still in it. And the guy that excavated it was a British Royal Engineer, and he also only had one foot, and he'd lost an eye in these campaigns in Afghanistan. So that was an interesting thing for the Commonwealth War Graves, who were able to come to us and say, well, this foot in the boot will get what they call a scant remains grave. Mm-hmm. They put it with there's a headstone, and it's the mortal remains of a soldier of the Great War. And they said, well, you know, we can't say it's an unknown soldier because the guy may have survived having lost his foot.
That's true.
We're able to say, well, we can prove that because a guy digging it's only got one foot.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. So that's got a headstone we know about. That's in the closest cemetery to De Bullecourt. We can go visit that. We can go and, you know, pay your respects to that individual soldier, and then other remains will probably go into that grave over the year when they get turned up. The Germans are a different matter. The process for finding bodies on Western Front battlefields, what you do is you stop work immediately, you report it to the local police, so they're able to verify that it's not, you know, not a murder or something similar that's taking place in Bullecourt, and then you tell the local mayor, or the mayoress in this case, and then the Commonwealth War Graves. That's the process. And then the war graves retrieve the body. Often, if you've got an archaeological team, they'll make use of your skills, and you can do the excavating and give them all the pieces from it. And then they determine basically by nationality what the process is from that point. Now, the German bodies, they are still recovered by the Commonwealth War Graves, and they go to the French authorities from the Brits, and then the French authorities then hand them over to the VDK, the German equivalent of the war graves. So our three German soldiers, or it's kind of 2.5 really of what was left of the third chap, they went to the VDK, and we're pretty certain they've been buried in Metz, which is a long way away from Bullecourt. And I think the Germans are so overrun trying to do work on the war dead of the Second World War on the Eastern Front and the Zillow Heights and things like that, that they're just inundated with work. And so long as these individuals are buried properly, That's as far as the research will go, unless you've got things like identity discs, which are, as you know, not particularly common to find. So,
of course, they're not government funded either, are they?
No, exactly. So it's a really tricky
thing. Not like Commonwealth War Graves, where our tax money goes to.
Exactly. So they've got far bigger ability to undertake. I mean, the British, as I'm sure you know, have this unit called the Joint Casualty and Compassionate Centre, sat within the Ministry of Defence. So they will do all the work to try and identify human remains from the First World War. They'll do searches for ancestry. They'll do isotopes. They'll do DNA. They'll do all the kind of forensic osteology to look at weights and measurements and heights, all this sorts of stuff. And all the little clues to go with the ephemera that the body's accompanied with, if anything, like the regimental insignia. They've got all the records. Germans don't have that. So what is such a sad thing is that we will never know who these three Germans are. And we've managed to, through chatting with people like Rob Schaefer, we've managed to narrow it down to, you know, certain companies of which particular Prussian units rather than a Württemberger unit. It's probably Prussian, but you know, that's a massive army. So being able to tell is just going to be impossible. I'm afraid we're just not going to know. So these individuals have been buried. They'll be unbekanntzelt up in a grave in Metz, but we don't know which. It'd be nice to go and visit them, but I just don't know whether that's going to be possible.
It's a different there's different rules on filming remains as well, because I know this from when we've done documentaries, and the Germans are the one where you can actually film the remains.
It's
you can't with anyone else, can you?
It's really interesting. It was made, you know, it's been made very, very clear to us by the Joint Casualty and the Commonwealth War Graves that we're not to be filming and showing British remains, which we haven't, and same for Australian remains. We found parts of Australians, and we found complete Australians, in fact, at Messines.
Yeah, because we found the New Zealander as well at Messines when we were doing the big dig. So
exactly. So you're able to show a drawing of it or the kit, but not the body. Yes, you're quite right. The Germans are showing all sorts of different things. So it changes though. The French are quite happy to show. To show it, you're probably familiar with the Grimsby Chums, you know, the Lincolnshires that were shown. And they were, you know, photographs all over the French press of them supposedly arm in arm lying in that mass grave with the boots on. You know, if I'd asked to kind of publish a photograph of that, let's say if I've excavated it, I know I would be told not to. So it's just different by country. You're quite right. There was a thing I saw in the news yesterday. I think it was doing the rounds on Facebook about a lot of North African troops have been found in a trench in France, First World War. And there's pictures of those guys skeletal in their boots. And so that's doing the rounds on Facebook. We have a real rule with our team as well, the excavation team, that we only let one person take the photographs, which is our photographer, Harvey. And so he's the guy that takes the photographs of our field work. So that it just cuts out the risk of anyone putting a smiley selfie on Facebook. Not that they would, but you know what I mean. You're not going to get this unofficial photographs of with lack of respect going out accidentally. And I think that's really important because it's all about dignity for these individuals, whether they're, you know, Australians, British, Germans, or whichever nationality. So you can see the rules. It is just a curiosity, the difference in attitude in Germany. The other strangeness for me in many ways is how our attitudes changed over the years. You think of the film The Battle of the Somme. Mm-hmm. It's part of the UNESCO inscribed part of world memory, and in that film there's bits of it obviously that are mocked up afterwards, but you can see British soldiers being killed. You can see them attacking the Hawthorne crater. These are chaps, I think, probably from the Middlesex regiment attacking the Hawthorne crater. And you can see some of them then retreating, and not all of them. You see them, some of them dropping. And these are guys being killed. And this is shown in the theatres in 1916 to mass audiences. I mean, more people watched this film than Star Wars when it came out.
Yeah, proportionately, because obviously box offices have gone up and it costs more and money's gone up, it's still bigger than Titanic.
It's Britain. Incredible. Is that right? That's incredible.
But it's the biggest.
There's the potential for family members who've lost loved ones on the Somme campaign to sit in a theatre and watch these people being killed. Can you imagine that now? You know, I don't know, watching news footage of the campaigns in Afghanistan or Iraq, and you see British soldiers being killed. Just an impossibility. You can't imagine it.
No.
So to have the prohibition on showing human remains in skeletal form from 100 years ago is a really interesting one, when at the time you could see people being killed on film. So it's just an interesting one, isn't it, how attitudes change over a century.
And definitely find it just in general, the German attitude to death in cemeteries and war cemeteries and things, like obviously it's different because they weren't given what we were given in terms of land and stuff, but it's a very different cultural attitude to death.
And they're often very different feelings, aren't they? I mean, they're just different designs. And some, you know, the pros and cons to everything. The sort of country garden style of the Commonwealth war graves is one style. And then the Germans are often in the sort of, quite often a kind of foresty look, which has its own real dignity, I think. But they're just very different designs.
Richard, thank you so much for joining us and teaching some of us, especially me, about World War One tanks, because I had absolute idea. So thank you so much. And we'll hopefully have you back on again.
That'd be great.
Join us tomorrow when Christopher Davis will be with us to talk all about Fishbourne Roman Palace. It's on the south coast of England and it's absolutely fantastic. And he's going to tell you why. So join us for that one. Don't forget that we do exist on Patreon as History Hack and on Patreon as well, which is Podbean's own version. Alina and I have had massive fun doing this in 2020, but life is going to change quite a lot next year and we're going to actually have to go and earn a living, etc. If we want to keep up the regularity that we've been bringing you and the kind of guests that we've been bringing you and the workload, then we will need your help. The incentives for joining on either of those platforms, we're revamping ourselves on both of them, so don't forget to go in. You can do as little as $1 a month and it all goes towards keeping up History Hack as regular as we've been able to bring it to you this year. We are now on YouTube. We are posting all of our new episodes on there and we have our own channel and we are gradually posting all of the back episodes because we have been made aware of the fact that you can only find the last 100 on some platforms. So you can go and listen to your heart's content and laugh at the cartoons and have a great time. So do go over there and subscribe.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.